Ah, that's just the only sound I feel like making at the moment. Bad news, people. As you may have heard, Mr. Wayne Kramer, guitarist, songwriter, activist, pioneer of punk rock, and just a good soul. He passed away. We just learned about it a couple hours ago. Wayne was 75 years old, and to be fair, those are some pretty hard miles, but damn it, he was one of the great ones. You know, he's gone. No idea how. It's just fresh news, but man, we were lucky to have him as long as we did. Now, if you're not familiar with him, I urge you to look him up. Spend some time with Wayne's music and story. He made his bones as the guitarist and founder and primary lightning rod for the band MC5, the Motor City 5 out of Detroit. Punk rock pioneers, I mean, from day dot, really. I mean, it was his band that helped sign the Stooges, right? Without the MC5, we may not have heard of Iggy Pop. And then from the MC5, Wayne's path went many places. He was very vocal in his activism and even ended up spending some time in prison, where he not only emerged stronger and wiser, but also more compassionate, honoring the inmates that he met and prisoners around the world with a charity, Jail Guitar Doors, founded with Billy Bragg, which helps in the rehabilitation of prisoners through music. And Wayne was always a very expressive soul. He got into experimental jazz and produced some incredible work throughout his life. Anyway, I hope we can honor the man today and going forward. I never have the album Kick Out the Jams far from my turntable. And today, I'm going to share this conversation I had with Wayne going way back to August 2016, which was part of episode 45 of the Vinyl Guide podcast. Just as we were starting out, Wayne was kind enough to come on and talk about the record, the censorship of Kick Out the Jams, talks about the Stooges getting signed. He talks about all sorts of different things, and we go through his career quite a lot. It's a pretty extensive interview. Please enjoy this conversation in full, no breaks, no ads, no nothing, but just a lot of love for Wayne Kramer and everything he's created. Wayne, thanks for the music and the wisdom. We're a better people because of you. All right, here we go. From August 2016, Mr. Wayne Kramer. Now here at the Vinyl Guide, we always enjoy speaking with music and history makers. And today we have someone on the line who clearly fits both categories. We're talking to Wayne Kramer of the MC5. How are you doing today, Wayne?
Terrific. Terrific. Thanks. Yourself?
Doing great. Hey, Wayne, look, there's a lot to talk about. A lot happened and is happening in your life. Of course, the music, the politics, your successes, some of the missteps, and of course, your charity, Jail Guitar Doors, which we'll dutifully cover shortly. However, for now, let's go back to the beginning. Which came first, the guitar or the politics?
The guitar came first. From the time I was a boy, I was kind of attracted to it. There was like a portal to a secret dimension that I wanted more of. You know, the sound of the guitar itself was, to me, it was the sound of liberation, sound of adventure, sound of power.
And at what age did you pick it up, and were you serious about it right away?
I was about 10. And yeah, well, I noticed in the world around me that people who played the guitar and sang songs, that girls really had great affection for them. some mystical reason that was beyond my comprehension. It just seemed to be a powerful force. My mother dated a guy who played music. He'd come over with his guitar and sing songs, and I could see it in her face, you know. I want some of that. That looks good.
That's always the that's pretty much the entry point for everyone who plays guitar. Can we talk about that transition from when you picked up the guitar to when you started playing in local bands?
Well, yeah, you know, it was probably took me 3 or 4 years. Let's see, I started, I was 10. I started playing in bands when I was around 13. So it took me about 3 years to master enough technique to be able to play with other people and learn songs. And then, you know, 13, 14, 15, we literally played, you know, today there's this genre known as garage band or garage music. We literally played in the garage. And that's what, you know, we would play like at our friends' parties in the basement or in the backyard, and work your way up to playing school dances and teen clubs. And then you work your way up to playing record hops and DJ hops and, you know, private functions where they would actually pay you. And then, you know, I was always on a track to being a professional musician. My dream was, you know, to be able to work in nightclubs and sleep all day and stay up all night with, you know, very hip people and do very cool and dark things.
And at what age did those cool and dark things start coming into the picture?
About 16. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because by the time I was 16 or 17, I was playing in nightclubs. And, you know, when I was a boy, my mother said, Wayne, you know, I want you to do what you want to do with your life. But this business about being a musician, yeah, I got to warn you that this is a very hard life, because you're going to have to work at night probably. And you know, that means you'll sleep during the day. And, you know, there are drugs and alcohol, you know, that are around that world of musicians. And there's also loose women.
And that ticked all the boxes for you.
I said, don't throw me in that briar patch, Bear Bear. Don't throw me in that briar patch. I couldn't wait to be a professional musician. That sounded like, and you know what? She told me true.
She's absolutely right.
Yep.
So you started going down this path. And at what point did you form the MC5?
Probably about, it started to take shape in my, I think I was in the 11th grade, so I was probably 16, 15 or 16. By the time I was ready to leave school at 17, the band was formed, named, the personnel was set. They were guys from my neighborhood. I asked around at school, you know anyone that plays an instrument that might want to be in a band with me? And I found the guys and pulled the thing together, and we eventually started to, you know, develop some ideas about, you know, what the heck it was we were trying to do.
So this is much or all of the original lineup, Tyner, Sonic Smith, all those guys around age 17 or 18, you guys were already a unit?
Yeah, we had a different rhythm section. We had a couple guys that were tremendous players, but they ultimately left the group because they couldn't relate to where me and Tyner wanted to go with the music, because we were listening to John Coltrane and Sun Ra, and these guys, they wanted to play roots rock, you know, and the bass player was a great bass player in the James Jamerson tradition, the Motown tradition. The drummer was a great backbeat, hard driving hitter, but he didn't want to play free. So they left the band, and that's when Dennis Thompson came aboard and Michael Davis.
And what a rhythm section those guys brought.
Indeed.
And this is, again, you know, around not quite 20 years of age yet. And the ideas and the politics that were happening at the time, at what point was that apparent that the beliefs and the ethos of the MC5 was different than other groups out there?
By about 1967, going into 1968, you know, we were young people at a time of tremendous upheaval in America. People, you know, if you weren't there, it's very hard to imagine, but the nation was more polarized than it is today.
That's saying something.
Yeah, and it was very volatile. You know, Malcolm X was assassinated. You know, to precede all this was the Kennedy assassination, JFK assassination. So that, you know, that set up, that ended this bright, shining future that many people saw with the Kennedys. And, then things started to go to hell in a handbasket. You know, the Vietnam War was escalating, civil rights were out of control, and then, you know, Martin Luther King was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, Manson, you know, it was a very dangerous and exciting time.
And with the MC5, of course, looking back now, the views and the position, the politics is very radical. The MC5 was preaching the changing of the establishment, which is what people are asking for today. Tyner and John Sinclair were in the picture, and of course, their politics colored what was happening with the MC5. Where were you at in it? Was it more about the music, or was the message equally as important?
I embraced initially it was a culturally revolutionary stance, which, you know, having to live through, you know, police violence, systematic government intrusion, it radicalized me, you know, to be falsely arrested, to be harassed, to be beat by the police, to be searched by them. This helped push me to a militancy about, you know, to a militancy that would express my frustration with the slow pace of change. You know, I was young. I was 19 years old, 20 years old, and I was right about everything, and I had all the answers, and I was going to live forever. Today, I know a little bit more about a lot less, and I'm definitely not going to live forever.
So if all of a sudden you had a time machine and could visit 18-year-old Wayne Kramer, what sort of advice would you give him?
I wouldn't give him any advice. I don't give anybody advice.
You'd probably smoke a joint with him.
It's unwise. Yeah, I probably would have smoked a joint with him.
So the band starts going from strength to strength, more and more popularity. You begin recording. There were a few records that were released around that time on a label called AMG Records. What can you tell us about those recordings?
They were our very first efforts at making records and writing songs. You know, we I was playing before the first wave of the British invasion bands. So my original inspirations were people like Chuck Berry and the instrumental bands of the era, Johnny and the Hurricanes and the Ventures. And, you know, all those like one-off, today they call them garage band singles, you know, Underwater by the Frogmen. All these, you know, crazed little novelty rock guitar records that were coming out that got a lot of exposure on Detroit radio. So by the time the band was up and rolling, the first wave of the British invasion had hit, and we were, you know, as impressed and influenced by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and then later, you know, the Who became, we felt like they were our contemporaries, but, you know, we were kind of in a contest with them to see who was going to take it to the next level. And as a guitar player, you know, I was really impressed with Jeff Beck, and am still impressed with Jeff Beck. He's still my hero. So, you know, we started to incorporate these what was happening, you know, in the world around us.
And your first single, the first record, I Can Only Give You Everything, and the other side, One of the Guys, it was on AMG Records.
Mm-hmm.
Who was AMG Records?
That was Arnold Mark Geller.
Sounds like a guy with money.
I wish. At one point, we met a guy who worked for MGM Records as a local sales rep. And he had two partners. His name was Cliff Gornoff, and he had a partner named Larry Benjamin and Arnie Geller. And they decided this triumvirate of music business executives, they thought of themselves as executives, were going to be a management company. So they wanted to manage the MC5.
They had no idea what they were in for.
Well, they had an idea. We go to this meeting in their office, and while we're in the meeting, the landlord comes to the office and, you know, is pitching a bitch because they haven't paid the rent. They're behind in the rent. And then, you know, they're giving us their opinions about, like, drug use, you know, like, you guys can't use drugs, you know, like, that's going to kill your career. Then the meeting ends, and one of them pulls us aside and, yeah, but can I get some weed from you? So these guys were complete hypocrites and complete phonies. And of course, we didn't, we agreed to make a record with them, but we didn't sign any management agreements with them. They were crazier than we were.
So you guys saw that at the beginning, but you let them release the record, which is yeah, highly collectible these days. Do you remember how many of those were pressed at the time?
I'm going to guess a few hundred, because the main thing was to get it on the radio. If you could get your stuff on the radio, that's how you sold records.
Mm.
They got a little bit of play, but they never cracked the big radio station in Detroit was called CKLW. And it was broadcast from across the river in Windsor, and it had huge 60,000 watt capacity, and it would reach down to like Tennessee on a good night. It was a hugely influential and important radio station, but they never got our stuff on there.
Okay, so it was a bit of a Hail Mary pass to record, make the record, and try to get some airplay and make something of it.
Yeah.
Okay, yep. And just staying with AMG Records, because that was your first record, we'll skip to your third really quick, which is a re-release of I Can Only Give You Everything, but with a different backside, which was I Just Don't Know. Was that also part of the deal, or was that an outtake that they used?
That happened way later.
Mm.
We had already gone through our whole career at Elektra Records and Atlantic Records. And Geller showed back up one day and said, hey, remember those old tracks? Now you guys are big and famous. Let me release these, okay? And we said, yeah, sure. And,
okay.
And nothing happened either.
He still couldn't get airplay. And then just skipping back, just let's be completist here. Your second record was, it was on a label called A Square Records, Borderline and Looking at You. Apparently that was released without your knowledge. Is that right?
No. No, we were completely involved in all aspects of that project. By then we were aligned with John Sinclair, and using the guidance that he gave us, and he produced the sessions, and we loved the sound that he got. And, you know, we all sat around in the basement and glued those record sleeves together. And Gary Grimshaw did an artwork on the package, and we just loved everything about it.
That's the one with the Coltrane image on the cover, yeah?
Yeah.
And who was A Square Records?
This was a guy up in Ann Arbor who worked in a record store. His name was Jeep Holland. I don't think he owned the record store, but he ran it. He was the manager. And he had this little label, this little regional territorial label, and he put out records by the Rationals, who he managed, and a couple other local bands. And, you know, we didn't know anything about the label end of it. So, you know, and we knew Jeep and we liked him. So he said he'd put it out. So we said, great, you know.
Mm, okay.
Because there's no money changing hands in any of these deals. This is all on the artist for survival basis.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, fair enough. You're lucky if you get a box full of the records at the end of the whole thing.
Yeah.
What do you remember how many of those were pressed up? Yeah. I mean, you glued them all together. Maybe you remember how many you guys assembled?
I don't know, the same thing, you know, probably 500. And they, you know, they've all been reissued over the years, but
so the popularity starts building. Of course, the country is shifting in many different ways. One of the events that really started to define the MC5 was the gig at the Democratic National Convention in 1968 in Chicago. How did you guys get involved and booked at that event?
Well, we knew, you know, we were friendly you know, in touch with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, and you know, we all, there was a great network of young people that felt that the nation was going in the wrong direction and that, you know, it was going to fall into our hands to clean up the mess, and we wanted to change it. And so, you know, they reached out to us. They were going to do a music festival they were going to call it the Festival of Life, to oppose the convention's Festival of Death. And, you know, they said all the bands were going to come and play, you know, the West Coast bands were going to come, and we, you know, our attitude was we would play anywhere, anytime anyone would let us. I mean, my attitude about how you promote your band is you play a lot. You play every chance you can get. And we like playing for outdoor events, and we like being involved with the people and the community that we were in. And we had done a lot of it. And so when they said, do you want to come to Chicago and play? We said, hell yes. Count us in. We're there.
And were there any other bands that played besides the MC5, or?
Not one.
Yeah.
They all had way more sense than we did.
And that was quite a long show for you guys. Do you remember the length of it?
No, it wasn't a long show, but that's a great rumor.
Okay, yeah. The rumor is 6+ hours.
Yeah, that's a great rumor. I love that rumor.
Have you ever played a 6-hour show?
Hell no. Are you crazy? But if I play an hour show, I want to go take a nap.
Fair enough.
20 minutes is good for me. I can really rock it for 20 minutes.
Well, that's you guys put out a lot of energy. And when it comes to the shows, you guys then, on the back of that DNC show, started attracting label attention.
Yeah,
if that's not a rumor, okay, good. And Elektra came knocking and signed you. What do you recall about those conversations with Elektra?
Well, they had a guy that was kind of their talent scout, who was very sharp, very erudite. His name was Danny Fields, and he came out to see us, and we met him through some mutual friends. And he was a brother, you know, and he liked to smoke weed like we like to smoke weed. And he was politically astute and culturally plugged in. And we liked him. I liked him a great deal right from the beginning. And he reported back to his boss in New York that, you know, this band could draw 3,000 kids, and, you know, they'd never had a hit record or anything, just on the strength of their live performance. And that, you know, this was a band that was that if they could convert this regional success to national and international success, they'd really have something. And they had just come off a huge success with the Doors. So they had money to work with. And we agreed that we liked their political awareness. They said that they would stand behind us, that they believed in First Amendment, and that if, you know, if we wanted to curse on a record, they would have no problem with it, and they had attorneys that would defend us if it came to that. And we said, great, you know, this is our company, these are our people, let's roll, let's make this album, let's carry a message.
There was a kinship, and they were saying all the right things, so it wasn't going to get any better than Elektra.
I think that was that's our position. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you were signed to Elektra, and actually you were one of two local bands signed to Elektra. They swabbed up the Stooges at the same time, I believe.
Yeah, I was in the room when Danny Fields said, are there any other bands like you around? And I said, no, there are no more bands like us, but we have the little brother band that you might find interesting. They're called the Psychedelic Stooges. And he, of course, loved the Stooges. And we were sitting in Sinclair's office in the basement of our commune. And we had Danny was there, and he had his boss on the phone, and Sinclair was there, and the Stooges manager was there, and I was there. And Danny's talking to Jack Holtzman in New York, and he says, okay, I got both the band managers here. What are we going to do? And he comes back. He says, all right, Jack's offering $10,000 for the big band and $5,000 for the little band. And we all said yes.
The next step was then, of course, to record the debut album. Did you have the songs ready to go, or was there a matter of preparation that needed to be done?
No, it came together pretty quick because, you know, all our work went into performing live and building this live set that would just, you know, devastate the audience. We wanted to just be a blast of energy that no one had ever experienced before. To the exclusion of recording, we didn't spend much time at all recording. We would write new songs in the rehearsal room and work them up, and it was all about playing live. So the idea to do a live album, on one hand, appealed to us because it was revolutionary. You know, nobody had done that before. Usually bands did two or three albums and then did a live album. And but there was also the consideration from Elektra's point of view, which was this band is, you know, musically verging on chaos. And to get them in a studio and to get them to conform to the recording process was going to be a long and expensive undertaking. So, you know, it suited their purposes to do a live record, and what did we know? We went with it.
Sure, sure. So what better way to market a band that has these dynamite live shows than to record a live album? It makes...
Yeah,
makes perfect sense. Now, the sequence of the album, was that pretty much the sequence of the live shows, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's very close, yeah.
So if you listen to Kick Out the Jams, that's about as close as you can get to, you know, having the real experience of an MC5 live show back in the day, sequentially and everything.
Correct.
Let's talk a little bit about the recording of the album. It was recorded in Detroit, at the Grand Ballroom, across 2 days. What do you recall about those shows?
Well, it was the Grandee Ballroom. Grandee. That's the way we pronounced it. The venue was an old 1930s and 40s ballroom dancing facility. It was in its day, it was a beautiful structure. And these kind of ballrooms were, I think, probably all across the country, but I know that they were all across the city of Detroit, because in the eras before radio, you know, people would go out dancing in these beautiful ballrooms, these lovely Rococo, you know, giant. They'd hold 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 dancers, wooden dance floors and proscenium stages, where big bands could come in and play, and the acoustics were very live, very hot room, and the bands, you know, the sound would project out with acoustic instruments. And so by the time we got this place in the 60s, it was perfect for us we rehearsed in the venue and we performed in the venue. So we were able to to really learn how to play at maximum volume and how to make, you know, how to make it sound good in that room. And so we recorded the stuff on Friday and Saturday nights. We just made it a special two-night recording concert, and all the fans came, and they acted the way they always acted at MC5 shows, and the stomping in the beginning, the anticipation, and then the band rushes out on the stage, and everybody cheers, and J.C. Crawford does his intro and gets everyone even jacked up to a higher level of excitement. And then we break into Ramblin' Rose and we tear the roof off the sucker.
And
since we're going deep, mm-hmm. I personally, I can't speak for the other fellows, but I was intimidated by the pressure of making the record, and I was very nervous. And when I went out to start Ramblin' Rose, when I slid down and hit that first open E string for the bong, bong, boo, da, bong, boom, my E string went out of tune. And it threw me. It took me off my out of my flow. And I never quite got it back.
Oh. And that's the one that's on the finished record, because you guys recorded a couple of shows, so that's the take that was used, a slightly out of tune E string.
Yeah, you can hear it. I think the first note is in tune, and then from there on, it's...
Okay, I'm gonna listen for that.
If you listen to Kick Out the Jams, you'll hear the dissonance between me and Fred's guitar. It's pronounced. I have a master recording of the session, and I've put it out on the computer and listened to it and isolated the tracks. And it's, I don't know, it could be a semitone, it could be, it's pronounced.
Oh, okay. And is that it was that way for the rest of the show?
Yes.
Okay. There wasn't a time to recoup.
No, because, you know, there were no electronic tuners in those days. We tuned up with a harmonica. By ear. And you know, we didn't really, we knew a little bit about how strings stretch over the court, you know, like, but we didn't know, like, as much as I know today. I know how to stretch my strings out before I go play and they'll stay in tune. But we didn't know that then. So you'd put a new set of strings on, tune your guitar up, go out and play. And, you know, by the second tune, your guitar is completely out of tune.
So you hit the E on Ramblin' Rose. Now, Ramblin' Rose is an interesting opener, particularly since the lead singer doesn't sing on it, at least your version
right.
of it. What was
right.
the decision like for you to sing that song, particularly in the falsetto voice?
It was aspirational. I don't know if you've ever heard the original by Ted Taylor. But, you know, Ted was a rhythm and blues artist from somewhere in the South, Memphis maybe, and he was a brilliant producer and songwriter, and he had a unbelievable voice. You know, he's one of those guys that had like 5 octaves he could sing. And he sang it in a falsetto, and I aspired to sing it like he sang it. If you ever hear the original, you'll hear the difference.
Okay, we'll hear what you were going for.
Yeah, let's say I fell considerably short of the mark, but I did it anyway because I'm 20 years old and I'm all fired up and I'm good to go and I'm in my band and I'm singing this shit, you know.
Yeah, fuck you if you don't like it.
Yeah, I'm singing it.
So then after that song, was Tyner off stage, and then after Ramblin' Rose, he would come on and start to kick out the jams, spit?
Yeah, he'd come running out, you know, like we'd finish that tune. I'd come out and start the set, and I'd, you know, the band would be slamming, and I'd be dancing all over the stage. And then Tyner would come out, and, you know, the energy level would ratchet up another notch, and I mean, it was, you know, we had designed it to be as exciting as it could be. We were really trying to reproduce James Brown live at the Apollo.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. The band comes out, warms them up a bit, and then all of a sudden, here comes the centerpiece. And
yeah,
okay. So Tyner would come out. He'd say the famous line, "It's time to kick out the jams, motherfucker," and then wham, the crowd would go crazy. So that was another level there. Now, the first pressings of the record had him saying, you know, motherfucker. And subsequent pressings, that was changed to brothers and sisters. What was the discussion like behind the scenes when that change, when that switchover was made?
When, you know, we were not completely naive to the world we lived in. And we knew that Kick Out the Jams, Motherfucker would never be a hit single on the radio. That was beyond, reasonable, logical possibility.
You guys had big dreams, but they weren't that big.
Yeah, I mean, we used to say, you know, I may play, but I'm not always dumb. So we had a strategy. The strategy was, we'll record a version, Kick Out the Jams, Brothers and Sisters, for the single. Have Elektra release the single. Let the single go as high as it could possibly go in the charts. Leave it in the charts as long as it's going to stay up there. And when it comes down out of the charts, release the album with the real version of the song on it. We knew, just like the live show, everything would ratchet up a level. But they couldn't stop us then because we would be a bona fide radio hit band.
Mm.
So what happened is they released the single. The single was number 2 in Detroit. It was number 6 in New York. It was on the air in Chicago. It was on the air in San Francisco. Both of the rating services that radio used to pick their hit records had picked the record as a smash hit. When the single took off, Elektra ignored our strategy and released the album immediately. In the following week, kids' parents hit the roof. When the kid came home with that record and they heard Kick Out the Jams, Motherfuckers, parents went insane. People that ran record stores that were selling the record were arrested by the police for selling pornographic and obscene material.
There were actual arrests made for selling your record.
Yes, the prosecutors went into high gear about, we have to prosecute this band for saying what they're saying. We can't allow it. Elektra came to us and they said, you know, the rack jobbers are returning the records. They refuse to play any of our stuff. They won't even play Switched On Bach, you know. We're losing terrible money here. You know, can we put out a clean version of the album? You know, we're dying here. And we said, guys, we told you what to do. You didn't do it. Now you created a problem. And you know what? We will not allow you to release a clean version of the album. That would make us look like complete sellout, like we crumpled. And they said, oh, okay, well, it's in your contract. You have the right. And all right, then. Okay, guys. Yeah, we wish you'd decided differently, but okay. And then they went back to New York, and they released it anyway.
And what was the first time that you became aware that they had gone against your wishes? And what was the reaction?
Oh, I was furious. I mean, we were all livid. I mean, I mean, this was bad.
Mm-hmm.
This was bad for us. It was bad for our relationship with our audience. It was bad business. It was short-sighted. It was a mess. And then, you know, we had a buddy who ran an underground newspaper who was, they were about to get kicked out of their office. So we said, let us buy an ad. We'll buy an ad for the album. And there was a big department store in Detroit called Hudson's that we'd all gone to all our lives. It's an institution. And Hudson's refused to sell our record because of the obscenity. And so we put on the ad, Kick Out the Jam is now available. Fuck Hudson's.
You called out the store right by name there.
Yeah. And put the Elektra logo on it and sent them the bill. Since we had the right in our contract to do our own advertising.
Mm-hmm.
So Elektra determined that we were unprofessional, and they dropped us from their label immediately.
Well, with Kick Out the Jam still in the charts, still selling well, they pulled the ripcord.
Correct.
Oh, okay. And how many hours was it until you had an offer from a different record company?
Oh, it took a few days. Let me tell you, Danny Fields, the guy who signed us, got into such a fight with his superiors that one of them slapped him across the face over the MC5 problem, and they fired Danny.
And did he stay in the MC5 camp for a period of time afterward?
Yeah. I wanted him to manage us. He didn't want to be a manager. I said, come on, because Sinclair was going to the penitentiary,
mm-hmm.
and we needed management. And I said, Danny, you know, you're the man. You're the guy that's managed the band. And he didn't want to do it. Later, he went on to manage the Ramones, and of course, the Ramones have become a very popular and successful band.
Mm-hmm.
But in these days, he didn't know what he wanted to do, and
yeah,
and management is a terrible job. So I don't blame him for not wanting to do it.
But you guys still had his counsel, and I'm assuming he guided you through the next steps of the career. Now, before we move on, were you happy with the album Kick Out the Jams, with the recording, with the process, aside from the controversy and the challenge with the motherfucker and everything? Were you happy with the record?
To be completely honest, I was not happy with the record. Jack Holzman, Elektra president Jack Holzman, said to me, Wayne, if you don't like the recording, we'll just record it again until we get it the way you guys want it. And I said I didn't like it, and I was outvoted. You know, Sinclair loved it, Holzman loved it. I don't know what the rest of the band thought, but I said it wasn't a great performance. You know, the MC5 was a mercurial band, and on a good night, it was absolutely astounding. But, you know, we didn't have good nights every night. Some nights we'd just be off and, you know, things wouldn't fall together. And they, in my opinion, they didn't fall together that night. I thought it was not a good performance of the band. I had better performances recorded on my own reel-to-reels that I did just to hear what we were playing of nights that I thought that, you know, man, this shit is cool. Mm-hmm. So, and then the artwork... You know, they showed us some mock-ups of artwork, and it was very cool technique of kind of superimposing one photograph over another. And I said, yeah, I love that. That looks great. And then what came out, I don't know, it looked kind of garish to me, and I didn't like the photograph of Tyner, and I just thought it was like a big mishmash. And the art director at the label puts his own picture on the album cover. He's up in the corner. You see this white dude with a blue business shirt on and a tie and glasses. He's the art director. He puts himself on the record. He's the guy that slapped Danny Field. So, you know, I thought Sinclair's liner notes were cool. They were very provocative and, mm-hmm. and, you know, accurate for how we felt, and then, you know, they took those off and issued this quote clean version of the record, and the whole thing was kind of a debacle as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from anyone's enjoyment of the record. It's a great historical artifact of a great band, you know, and a great night. I mean, you can feel it. It's exciting, and it's unlike anything else that was happening in that time, and I'm very proud of it. But you know, you asked me, and I'm going to tell you true. You know,
sure, no, that's fine. And
that's how I feel.
And I don't, quite honestly, Wayne, I don't think it diminishes anyone's appreciation of this record, because it really is, just like you said, a historical artifact. That's a, you know, it's a timeless record. How many thousand artists, bands, musicians have been inspired by this? But in your mind, and in your experience, there were better nights to record. You would have liked to have had this a package that, based on your experience of what the band did best and recording the band at its best, have you come to be okay with it? Are you now more appreciative now than at the time?
I love it, you know, especially when I got the multi-tracks and I was able to really analyze them from this perspective today, of in the era of quantizing and auto-tune, and you know, to hear how out of tune the guitars were and how, you know, the tempo rushes forward and bogs back, and you know, the vocal pitch and everything, and I just think it's wonderful now.
It is definitely a moving record, and there's nothing sterile about it. It is true.
Oh.
Is it your favorite MC5 album, or?
No.
Yeah? Okay, so let's talk about the Atlantic years. So you guys moved to Atlantic. You start recording what became Back in the USA?
Yep.
And what was that transition like from Elektra to Atlantic?
Very painful. Because, first of all, we lost John Sinclair. John had his third conviction for possession of marijuana. And he had a long vendetta against him by Detroit police narcotic officer, Lieutenant Warner Stringfellow. He had arrested John originally, and John was a poet. And John wrote a poem called The Poem for Warner Stringfellow. And in that poem, he indicted Warner and really ripped him a new one. And Stringfellow took it personally and said, I'm gonna fix you, you rotten motherfucker. And he did. And he arrested John two more times for possession of marijuana. And in those days, the third conviction for possession of marijuana was a mandatory 9.5 to 10 years in state prison. John gave two joints to a female undercover police officer who he was trying to get in her pants. And he thought, you know, if he give her a couple joints, am I going to get a little something? And she turns out to be the police. So he had this case pending. And it finally had gone to trial right at the period of that transition from Kick Out the Jams to Back in the USA. And John was ultimately sentenced to 9.5 to 10 years for possession of two joints of marijuana. So it was a very painful time for me and the band, you know, because John was our mentor and our manager and our interlocutor between us and the business world and you know, authority and everything else. So there we were, stuck with, you know, Danny had jumped into the picture and tried to hook us up with some professional music business managers from New York City, which all turned out to be a huge disaster because none of them could relate to the MC5. You know, culturally, musically, they just took us on because we had a record in the charts.
You were a product.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
Those relationships all, you know, were fraught with painful complications and failures and And you know, back in the USA was a tough record to make because the band had no real experience with the recording process, the rigors of the recording process. And especially the rhythm section, you know, we had developed this way of playing that was idiosyncratic, and, you know, tempo was a flexible thing, and tuning was imprecise. And although Fred and I were good guitar players, and we played, you know, consistently, Fred was a impeccable rhythm guitarist and really powerful, solid rhythm player. And I'd learned how to play rhythm by playing with him. So if we locked into a pattern, we were going to kill you with it. And but the rhythm section was a lot looser. And, you know, we encouraged them to play outside and to improvise like our heroes, you know, Elvin Jones and Sonny Murray. And if you ask Dennis Thompson today, he'll tell you Elvin Jones is still his favorite drummer. And Michael Davis, as a bassist, had no experience playing the bass when he joined the band. So he didn't come up with, you know, any training about how the bass fits with a band, you know, what any musical theory training, like what notes fit with what chords. So he just kind of improvised his own style from the beginning, and the guitars really carried the music. So his playing was very loose and spontaneous and undisciplined. So he would, for example, think nothing of missing chord changes. I mean, he'd blow through chord changes, and he wasn't even conscious of that he missed the chord change. He's jamming, you know.
Just roll on.
Yeah, and so we're in the studio, and we're trying to make this record, and we're listening to the playback, and it's like, yo, Michael, you know, you just missed the change. Oh, really? Oh, and, you know, we hadn't even gotten to the technological point of punching in parts yet. We were still recording the band, the performance live, so we'd have to go out and record the whole song again, and he would miss the changes again. So, you know, this is like turning into weeks and months of recording and not having anything worthwhile. And we ended up, John Landau, who of course has gone on to great recognition as Bruce Springsteen's manager and producer, was working with the band as our producer. We were his first production project. And John's a brilliant man, and he could really understood music, and he could play a little bit too. He may have even had some training. And so he understood it culturally, and he understood it personally, and he was able to see what was happening in the band, where the strengths were and where the weaknesses were. And he had come to the conclusion as the producer that we needed to record the record from the ground up with bass and drums, so that we had the bass and drum tracks correct, then put guitars on, then put the singing on, then put percussion or whatever else, and then mix it. And it was a real laborious process, and I ended up playing all the bass parts. Michael wasn't prepared for the rigors of it, and so I played them.
And that style of recording is the antithesis of what you guys were used to and what you shown with Kick Out the Jams, because rather than recording you as a live band as one unit, this is more of an assembly line studio work.
Yeah.
So it
correct.
So it really becomes doesn't have the energy. The band isn't playing together. It's pieced together.
Correct. Some of the tracks still came out very well. And you know, we were criticized so severely for
the looseness of kick out the jams. You know, you got to remember, I was a young guy. I had poured my heart and soul into this band. And when Kick Out the Jams came out, we got some brutal critical reviews. And in those days, and especially at my age, those really got to me. You know, I admit, my feelings were hurt. I felt embarrassed. I felt emasculated. I felt like, you know, they got this all wrong. You know, who the fuck are these fucking writers, you know? And you know, Lester Bang said that we couldn't tune our guitars, and, you know, that pissed me off. Even though he was right, we couldn't, but it still pissed me off. Because I knew we could play, you know, especially me and Fred. We, you know, we were good guitar players, man. We know how to play. And so when it came time to make the next record, a studio record, I was determined to answer my critics. And I wanted to make a record that everything was in tune and the tempos were correct. And you know, the political content was to the point. And there was no fat on this record. And this is in the, you got to remember, this is in the time of the 20-minute drum solo and, you know, the 30-minute guitar solo and the 15-minute bass solo. And, you know, songs were 12 minutes long. And you know, every song on that record is like 2.5 minutes long.
Yeah. Yeah. The longest one is 303.
Yeah. That's a Chuck Berry tune, probably.
Actually, no, 416. Let me try. So,
ballad.
You always have to have one. So what in your mind? What's the highlight of Back in the USA?
Human Being Lawnmower is the apotheosis of that period. I think Tyner wrote that tune, and he wrote the music. It came. He brought the tune in. Like him and I were in the beginning, him and I were the songwriting team in the band. We wrote all the songs on Kick Out the Jams, Rob Tyner and Wayne Kramer. We credit everybody because we were communists. But Rob and I wrote the tunes. So he brought the tune in to me, and like him and I were going to work out the arrangement, and then we'd present it to the band. And you know, he shows me the opening riff is like do 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 ba do bong bong bong. I said, great. So I repeat that again. He said, no. I said, what? Yeah, it's a great riff, Rob. So I repeat that four times, right? He said, no, you just play that once. The song was through composed. Nothing repeats. It's figure upon figure upon figure. In a kind of, you know, cinematic, I mean, that's the kind of stuff I do today, scoring film and television. That's what, you know, through compose is not song form. Song form is AABA or ABAB.
And it revisits a particular theme, but you're not building on a theme in this particular case.
Correct. And he had the whole thing in his head and had it all worked out. Fred and I added some changes over the guitar solos to open that section up a bit, but Tyner came up with the whole thing. He was such a genius in almost everything he did. I mean, he was, you know, he was the first guy that he designed his own clothes. You know, he was a great graphic artist. He was a great cartoonist. He was a poet, lyricist, a dancer, visionary. I mean, there was no one like Rob Tyner.
And he was really into jazz and hard bop and Coltrane, Archie Shepp.
Yep.
How did those influences permeate into the MC5?
Well, he turned me on to it. And, you know, Fred and I both, we knew about jazz from listening to jazz guitarists, you know, Jim Hall and Mundo Lowe and Kenny Burrell and, so, you know, we knew that as guitar players, you know, we're listening to all the best guitarists, and they're the best guitarists are the jazz guys. And then, you know, we had been listening, we had heard My Favorite Things, Coltrane's record, and, you know, we were impressed with the, whatever it was, 18-minute version of the tune. And then, you know, Tyner kind of opened our ears up even further to the hard bop. Like you said, you know, Jackie McLean and Cannonball Adderley. And then Sinclair, you know, busted it all open with the free jazz movement, the Albert Eiler and Sun Ra and Cecil Taylor. And we would listen. I listened to these records all day, every day.
And after Back in the USA, there was one final album, High Time. What's your recollection of...
That was the best record the MC5 ever made. You know, forgive me if I'm being redundant, but, you know, Marshall McLuhan's take on media, that there is hot media and cool media. And, you know, you go to a live performance, that's a hot media. You know, you're there in the room, you can smell it, you're sweating, the lights, the band's playing, people are moving, you're getting jostled around. It's a very physical, visceral experience. Listening to a record is a cool medium. And, you know, you put the record on and you wash the dishes, you put the record on and you make love to your girlfriend, you put the record on with you're hanging out with your friends and you're listening to music, or you're in the car, you're listening. So they're two different parts. And the MC5 had the live thing dialed in pretty good. But it took us three records to learn how to make records, to be creative in the recording studio. And we did that with the third album. The songwriting had matured. The playing had matured. The technology had matured. We had a new producer, and we had the technology to punch in where... So we knew that, like, the rule was on the sessions, if we're playing a tune and everybody knows where they're at in the tune and it's sounding good and Michael misses chord changes, don't worry about it. Keep playing it how you're playing it. And he can go back later and fix those adventures in harmony.
Everything was just starting to come together then. The band was maturing. Technology was kind of there. You're learning how to work within the studio. Why was it the last record?
Well, because we had, in the fiscal world, in the economic world of the record business, we sold no records. So they have no interest in keeping us around. We had, our bad behavior was such that, our unprofessionalism was such that we couldn't even get booked. We had, you know, like no shows on gigs so much that all the major promoters wouldn't hire us. And Bill Graham blackballed us.
Was there a particular event why Bill Graham did that?
Yeah, we were, Elektra wanted to present us to New York City with a big bang. So they wanted us to play at the Fillmore East. And we went into New York, and there was a militant radical group in the community and around the Lower East Side, around the theater, who Bill had given the theater to on Wednesday nights for local bands and poets and political organizing, whatever they wanted to do. So they were pissed off that we were going to take their Wednesday night. So we said, you know what? We'll come and play for you guys for free the week before, unannounced. And they said, great, and we did, and it was, everything was, you know, good. And the next week at the big event that Elektra promoted, they demanded like 50 tickets. And Graham wasn't, you know, Graham wasn't a punk, and he said, go fuck yourself. And They were hanging out in the front of the theater, and he went out to throw them off onto the sidewalk, and they got into a fight, and somebody hit Graham in the face with a chain and broke his nose, and Graham thought it was Rob Tyner that did it, because the dude that he was fighting with was a white boy with afro, and Tyner, you know, was...
There wasn't a whole lot of them walking around.
Right. So Graham thought it was the MC5 that beat him up. So he said, you know, you will never play in my venues, and you won't play in any venues of any the other promoters that I'm associated with. And we didn't. So, you know, Atlantic only let us make that record out of their contractual obligation. You know, the entire promotion campaign consisted of one half-page ad in Rolling Stone magazine that we had to share with a new band that they were promoting called the Allman Brothers.
So it was pretty much DOA.
DOA, my brother, DOA. It comes to the bitter end.
Was there a discussion between the band that this was it, or everyone just kind of went their separate ways and it was just unspoken, everyone knew?
No, we struggled on for maybe another year. We made a toehold in Europe, and so we started going over there on tour, and we got new management in London. A guy named Ronan O'Reilly took over the band's management, and Ronan founded Pirate Radio in England, Radio Caroline, and he tried to save the MC5, and he did a good job. He almost saved it, but not quite.
Good effort.
He tried to get us a new record contract, and the night that the record executive showed up, certain band members got too high and fell off the stage, and it was a big fucking mess, and it was awful. The end of it came up. We had booked I think it was like our sixth or seventh tour of Europe. It was going to be the best tour yet. It was going to be like 2 weeks in Italy and Scandinavian television, and the money was very good. And 2 days before the tour, Tyner quit the band. And then when Tyner quit the band, Thompson quit the band. Michael Davis had already been fired from the band. So Fred Smith and I got on a plane and flew to London and met a pickup drummer in the dressing room of the first show with no lead singer. And, you know, I didn't even know the lyrics to half the songs. You know, I got to go out and try and sing these tunes. And, it was terrible. And the tour was a nightmare. So we go back to Detroit. And there's one last New Year's Eve gig at the Grandy Ballroom for, like, I don't know, $500 or something. And, you know, everybody was there, all the original guys, and we're playing, and there's a few hundred kids, and it was just so awful and just such a spirit-crushing night. That was truly the end of that era of that band and those people. But I'll tell you that it was not unique. I mean, this is a story of rock bands, you know. How many thousands of bands have come and gone over the last 30 years? You know, they don't come to stay. They go. Very few survive over decades. Usually the ones that survive achieve a great success right out of the box, you know. The Who, the Rolling Stones, REM, U2. These bands all had hit records pretty much right out of the box. It's almost impossible to survive in a rock band. You see them come and you see them go, but mostly you see them go.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, so many bands that, you know, in like a lion, out like a lamb. But few have the sort of renaissance and the impact that that the MC5 did. They're now being revisited and regaled, and the inspiration that was created during that very brief tornado of a period. It's good to be able to see that sort of appreciation come back, particularly when you're still around to be able to enjoy it.
I can't say that I disagree with you. You know, it's great to be recognized for work that you do, and to experience camaraderie and mutual respect of my fellow musicians, you know, who really, those are the guys I'm actually playing for anyway. And if it's, you know, what I did was important to them and they appreciate it, that's meaningful for me. I'm proud of the work we did, and you know, records are like, you know, little time capsules, and seems like every couple of generations, the next generation discovers the MC5, and so it's you know.
I'm telling you, I put this album on the other day, and my 7-year-old has reacted to it. You know, you've got fire in a bottle, and most musicians, most musicians aren't fortunate enough to be able to do that, and you have, and you've had a life well lived. You've certainly made it quite interesting for yourself. So let's talk briefly about the next chapter of your life, where, you know, you right now your focus is on this project, Jail Guitar Doors. Can you speak a little bit about the genesis of this project?
Well, it's no secret I served a federal prison term in the 1970s, and while I was incarcerated, a new music form emerged called punk rock, and the Clash, the British, wonderful British band, wrote a song about me going to prison called Jail Guitar Doors. I was thrilled when I got out and found out about it, and thought it was a terrific show of solidarity from brother musicians. And, you know, met them when they came to town, and we became friends, and we're still good friends. And then that was the end of it. I thought, well, this is a nice thing they did. And so I'm trying to get on with my life. Mm-hmm. And I watched over the next 30 years as more and more people just like me went to prison for longer sentences under worse conditions. And it pissed me off. And I've been an activist all my life. And I decided I had to do something. You know, I think one person can make a difference. And what can I do? I'm a musician and I'm an ex-convict. And maybe I could be a bridge between these two communities, and maybe I could take musicians into prisons and do concerts. That's kind of the best I could come up with. And so I got a bunch of musicians together, Tom Morello and Jerry Cantrell and Gilby Clark and Don Was and Handsome Dick Manitoba and Perry Farrell. And we all went into Sing Sing, the infamous maximum security facility in New York. And I took the wonderful British activist and troubadour Billy Bragg with me into that prison. And as we were getting ready to perform, I noticed Billy had a guitar he was playing, and on the guitar was written Jail Guitar Doors. And I hadn't thought about that since I got out of prison. And I said, Bill, what's up with that? He said, oh, it's an old Clash B-side. Have you ever heard it? And I said, Bill, the song's about me. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, what are the lyrics? He said, right. Let me tell you about wine and his deals of cocaine. He said, oh, bloody fucking hell. I forgot all about that. It is about you. And I adore this man. I love him so much and admire him so much. And he's such a solid brother. But, you know, I assured him this was no big deal. And he started to tell me that he had launched an independent initiative in England to provide guitars for prisoner rehabilitation. And he decided to name it Jail Guitar Doors to honor Joe Strummer's life's work. And by the time we finished the concert and we're on the bus back to the city, I said, you know, this is a good thing that you're doing in Britain. You're English, but you know, I'm an American, and I'm an American musician, and I'm also a ex-convict. And I'm an activist too, and you know, I want to take this on for the United States. And he said, good, because I was just about to task you with it. he said, you're the only one that can do it, Wayne, because you've been inside. You know how the system works. So on that day, Billy Bragg, my wife, Margaret Kramer, and I formed Jail Guitar Doors USA. Today, our instruments are in over 60 American prisons. We run songwriting workshops in county jails in Los Angeles, Chicago, San Diego, Austin, Texas. And we're working to set some up in Baltimore and Philadelphia now. And we still have the program going that we started at Sing Sing. We're starting to work upstream. We're going into the California Youth Authority. And we just started some songwriting workshop programs there.
Mm. Recently, you've been in the news for some shows that were around some of the California correctional facilities. Can you talk about those a little bit?
On Wednesday of this week, we had planned to present Prophets of Rage to 900 prisoners at the Norco State Prison in Southern California. And the concert was, you know, a reward for prisoners that had worked hard to rehabilitate themselves. And the facility management, the administration was 100% behind us, and we have a longstanding relationship with them. And about an hour before showtime, the California Department of Corrections headquarters in Sacramento denied us access and denied us the ability to put on the show. So what happened was there was some elements in the community that phoned in anonymous calls to the local newspapers, media, and the Department of Corrections that we were aligned with the Black Lives Matter movement and that we were going to foment a riot in the prison and that people were going to be hurt. And so they canceled the concert. This is a very sophisticated political strategy by certain elements in the corrections industry. It's nothing new to me. You know, when you go to prison, you start to learn how arbitrary things can be, how arbitrary decisions are, and that you have no recourse. You have no one to appeal to, that they're not answerable to anybody. So what we did is we set up a band on the street outside the prison and we rocked them. And, you know, we were able to successfully maintain our good relationship with the prison staff and the warden. She even came out afterwards and thanked us and said that men behind the fence were all in their housing units. And they all pressed up against the windows and they heard everything we were saying to them and they heard the music. And then they know that, you know, we promised we'd come there and play and we kept our promise. And the local police were cooperative with us and the city manager was cooperative and the prison guards were cooperative. And we were able to really make lemonade out of lemons. So what they attempted to do blew up in their face.
Yeah, you're. I imagine by this time, you're pretty used to people fucking with you, and this was an interesting way to send a message not only to the prisoners to say yes, we did keep our promise, and you know we're here for you, but also to send a message to the people who hide behind that anonymity and those sort of tactics. The chicken shit tactics, to say we are here.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're not going anywhere. You know, the people that run California's prisons know that, you know, we are of service to them. And, you know, the federal government gave us the authority to do good work when they assigned us the 501c3 tax status, mm-hmm. And we're not deterred. Mm-hmm. we are moving forward. You know, this is if people want to help us, you know, they can go to jailguitardoors.org and they can make a donation. You know, funding is a problem. You know, it's my experience has been that if you want to save the baby seals or puppies, money comes flying out of people's pockets. If you want to help save human beings, adult felony offenders, not so much.
It's a tough hill to climb on that one.
It's a hard sell.
You also have some gigs coming around to raise funds and to raise awareness. There's a big show coming up in Los Angeles, I believe September 9th. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. It's our third annual Jail Guitar Doors event, fundraising event. Rock out and stay out. And it's at the most beautiful venue on the planet Earth. The Ford Amphitheater is a spectacular facility, holds just under 1,000 people. There is not a bad seat in the venue. It's an open air venue with the beautiful open California hills behind it. And the sound is perfect. The lighting is perfect. The setup is, you know, there's food and space and there's parking. And so we're lining up our artists now. I've got a couple of great graduates from the JGD program, men that were serving time that played our guitars and who are out now and doing well. They're going to come and perform, and we've got some good local bands, and we've got I'm going to play, of course, we're talking with a couple of headliners. And I, you know, until I confirm it, it would be unwise to.
Let's just say surprise guests.
Yeah, so and so might show up. You know? But, you know, in the past we've had, you know, Tom Morello has played with. We've had Jackson Brown and Ben Harper and you know, really wonderful artist activists that. Are sympathetic to what we're trying to do.
That's interesting. So you're going to have graduates of the program as well. So not only does this program help rehabilitate folks inside the correctional facilities, but it's also a bit of a farm team for opening acts. Good.
Yes.
I see your strategy. You're very, very smart. So, I want to close this discussion out on a high. First off, thank you very much for spending so much of your time and energy and going deep into this. A lot of our audience is really, you know, like myself, we like to know about our records. We like to know everything about them. We're fascinated with the stories behind them. And you certainly filled a lot of gaps in that knowledge and provided a lot of perspective. So really want to thank you for your time as a bit of a way to close out this discussion on a high note and to honor the work that you're doing. We reach out to one of our show sponsors, Voyage Air Guitars, about the Jail Guitar Doors program. Voyage Air Guitars is a guitar manufacturer. They're in Modesto, and they've agreed to donate some gear to the Jail Guitar Doors program.
Wow.
I want to definitely call that out. In the last 48 hours, they've started working with your manager, and they'll sort it out. They've started the email trail going, but it really is to honor the work that you're doing there, Wayne.
I'm knocked out. This is really, really sweet of you, man. I really appreciate that. And you know, speaking for the fellows, the voiceless fellows and women that populate the prisons, they appreciate it too. This it means a great deal. Thank you so much. That's really thoughtful and generous and kind of you. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Look, you know, you're doing the hard work. I made a couple phone calls, and the gear is coming from VoyageAirGuitar.com. So
fantastic.
All right, Wayne. Well, I'm going to let you go. I know you've got a lot of work to do. Godspeed to you, man. Take care, mate. Cheers.